This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
On today's Complicated Conversation, we welcome back one of our favorites, Tia Williams. Tia had a 15-year career as a beauty editor for magazines including Elle, Glamour, Lucky, Teen People, and Essence. In 2004, she pioneered the beauty blog industry with her site Shake Your Beauty. She wrote the best-selling debut novel The Accidental Diva and penned two young adult novels, It Chicks and 16 Candles. Her award-winning novel, The Perfect Find, is a Netflix movie starring Gabrielle Union. Her latest novel, 7 Days in June, was an instant New York Times bestseller and a Reese Witherspoon book club pick. Her new novel, A Love Song for Ricky Wilde, is out now, and it is magnificent, Tia. I have to insert that right here, and then I will stop my fangirling, but it is... so beautiful. I said this after I read the 7 Days in June that I hugged the book. I don't know what it is. I did this with this one too. I embrace your books at the end. Like I'm holding them. Like I'm just so in love. And it was so beautiful. And we are going to get into questions. And I will stop gushing long enough for you to give everyone just the elevator pitch for A Love Song for Ricky Wilde.
First of all, it is my distinct honor and pleasure to be here for a third time.
Yay.
Fabulous three-peat moment. Secondly, the idea of you hugging my books makes my year. Like, that's fabulous. Okay, so the quick pitch, A Love Song for Ricky Wilde. It is about a free-spirited florist who escapes the clutches of her very aristocratic sort of conservative family and moves to Harlem to open a flower shop, which has always been her dream. And when she's there, she meets a very mysterious, enigmatic musician and finds out that their lives are interconnected in ways that she couldn't have imagined. And there is voodoo magic, there is leap year magic, there is Harlem Renaissance stuff, there's... intrigue and madness, and yeah, it's very, very steamy and romantic.
Exactly. And I was like, don't forget the steam and the yes. Love. Yeah. So I want to start with Ricky Wilde. The opening line of the novel is 28-year-old Ricky Wilde possessed many talents. And then you go on to describe some of them, but conclude, but Ricky was terrible at one very important thing, being a Wilde. I was sucked in right away. We know as we read that Ricky is creative and passionate, and she's uninterested in anything having to do with the family business other than the flowers, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. She opens a floral shop. She at times thinks that she's too flighty, too messy, too much. You refer to her as a chaotic Gemini, which, of course, we loved. But it's Miss Della who sees that she has something to prove and that she's never had anyone, maybe never had anyone really build her up before. So tell us about Ricky and your development of her character.
So Ricky is the youngest out of four daughters in this family that's a funeral home dynasty. The dad does TED Talks on how to, you know, build your business. And, you know, they're multimillionaires, pillars of the Black community, like the example, you know, the Black excellence example. And in families like that, more often than not, you know, there's sort of a narrow definition of what that excellence means. And in her family, it was following in the dad's footsteps. So she has these three older sisters who are total you know, type A, by the book, you know, kind of girls. And then she...
They fall right in line.
They fall right in line. Yeah. And she just isn't like them. She can't bring herself to do something she doesn't want to do for a living. She is not satisfied with simply existing. You know, she wants to live and thrive. And I've always been interested in those characters, those Denise Huxtable characters that, you know, not even characters, people, real people that, you know, have the guts to, you know, fly by the seat of their pants and do the thing that they feel like doing that, you know, even if it looks a little crazy. Because I'm one of her sisters. Like, I am more like them, you know, like you make a to-do list and you cross each thing off and, you know, you keep your eye on the prize and don't let anything distract you. So I'm, you know, I've always, and my characters are, my protagonists are usually like that too. And so I wanted to write about a free-spirited woman.
My notes were, is this the farthest away from yourself that you've ever written? Being, right? You're the firstborn, you've got that Leo energy. This was farther away, but... And was that fun for you? Was that a challenge for you? Was it both? How was it getting into that character?
It was a challenge because my instinct, like, no, just do your homework. You know what I mean?
Like, that's exactly right.
Like, don't you want to make money? Like, it's right in front of you. Are you crazy? You know, like, these are her choices are not my choices.
Right.
You know? But I'm so glamorized by them that it was a really exciting thing to explore her motivations because they were so different than anything I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love that. Don't you want to do your homework? That is so me. As you know, I have the same fixed nature over here too, but, I would imagine it's kind of exciting and liberating, but also hard, like you said, because it's not your instincts. Well, we did mention, of course, that this is a steamy love story. So if we're going to talk about Ricky, we have got to go immediately next to Ezra. Oh, my God. I mean, Ezra, Bond, Percival, Walker, the fourth or fifth or sixth, whatever. He's described as beautiful in any era, anytime, anywhere. And I could not agree more. Just literally smolders on the page to me.
Oh,
I can't even. He's just also, I think for musicians, even though I've never had an actual musician, I just anyone who knows, I love songwriters, musicians as a romantic lead. You can't get any hotter to me already. So. But you wrote, he moved with such easy masculine strength, even his shrug, leonine. And I'm like, okay, first of all, is he a Leo? Can I just, I mean, you know, I have to just, that, you know, if she was a chaotic Gemini, is he, does he have some Leo vibes here?
Definitely. Okay, I think being a Leo helps. In my mind, he was a Leo.
Okay, good.
And being a Leo helps when you are a musician who has to go on stage and perform and move a crowd. You know, like during the Renaissance, the DJs were the pianists at the party. Like the guy playing the piano was the person, you know, in charge of the vibe. So that's a very, you know, front-facing type of personality. So I feel like,
And so in your development of him, it sounds like you did have that kind of magnetism and center of attention vibe that Leos have, but you also had to make him sort of this, like you said, like a timeless like hero or male protagonist. So tell us about Ezra and sort of where he came from for you.
Honestly, I had one of my favorite books is Isabel Wilkerson's the Warmth of Other Suns, and it is this fabulous collection of stories from people who made the Great Migration trek from the South to the North. Mm-hmm. And that's what, God, I'm going to spoil everything.
No.
That's what Ezra does. Mm-hmm. You know, like he, along with throngs of other Black people from the American South, were like, no, we can't do this anymore. We're going to pack up, you know, and take a train to parts unknown up north for a better opportunity, what they thought would be a better opportunity. And this book that Isabel Wilkerson wrote was just so fantastic because it really sheds light on the fact that, you know, these migrants were going from, in many ways, the old world to the new world. Mm-hmm. Like, first time seeing electricity, never hearing Northern accents. Oh, we have to wear shoes in Chicago? You know, like, just all of these walking through the streets trying to find the address of their sixth cousin who told them to, you know, to come up. And I'm just so fascinated by that journey. And so Ezra was born as I was reading that book. Like, I wanted to write someone who did that. And I thought that his story paralleled Ricky's nicely because she is a Black person who moved from the South to the North 100 years later in extremely different circumstances. Like, she's a, you know, a child of privilege and, you know, all this, except for that, is it,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. are the circumstances that much different? Because in many ways, Black people in America are facing the exact same thing that we faced back then. So, mm-hmm.
yeah.
All right. Well, I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about the idea for this novel, because I read an exciting part that made me want to talk to you about it, that the idea for this novel came to you during a bout of insomnia.
Yeah.
And you said one night around 2 or 3.
I wonder why Corinne's interested in that.
Yeah. I never sleep, but I never get good ideas when I sleep. I got to work on that. One night around 2 or 3 a.m., the story came to me like it dropped out of the sky into my head. I had these disparate elements that I had to connect: a cursed musician, a haunted piano, a brownstone in Harlem, leap years. And then there was a florist and a woman escaping the South. What was I supposed to do with all of that?
I love that.
Now, we know what you did with all of that because it's here in our hands. But I was curious, how did you get the courage to take that leap and bet on yourself that you could do all that? And it is, you know, I've read the book, so I know it's very Tia Williams. This is a Tia Williams book through and through. But someone who thinks, is this not? This doesn't sound like just a love story like I'm used to for 7 Days in June or The Perfect Find. What did you were like, this is a little different. How did you get the courage to do that, to follow that?
It was so different in my head. You know, it's like, who, somebody should write this book.
Yeah.
Be really good.
Exactly.
I wonder who's going to do it. And I was like, I guess I have to write it. Yeah. There is no other way to answer this question than just to tell the truth, is that I am like a husk of a person when it comes to every area of my life, but writing. Oh. I've never really had to get the courage to write anything. That's the one place where I just have confidence that I can do it.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh.
And I feel like my voice is so vivid. And the voice I have now when I write is the one that I had when I was 16 when I was writing. I'm not confused about what I sound like. I know who I am as a writer. So when I got that idea, I was like, oh, I will make that big, wild, new sort of idea fit into my voice instead of the other way around.
Mm.
Yeah.
And hopefully I did that.
Yes.
You did.
And so I love that you're already starting out with that clear clarity. Like, this is who I am, and this is what I'm writing. But you have to rally some troops behind you. Like, who do you tell first? Is it your husband? Is it your daughter? Your agent? Your editor? Who do you tell last? Who are you most scared of? But who do you need the most?
That was what I had encouraged to do. Because I was like, no one is going to buy this. No, you know, my agent is going to steer me in a different direction. And, you know, but I told her, and I had only told a couple of other people. And it was not a refined idea. It was like, I have these five elements, you know.
Yeah.
And she was like, I love it. Run with it.
Oh.
I don't know if my editor was like, I think my editor needed a little bit more convincing. But when she got it, she was like, yeah. And she was also, I have to give it up to her, Seema Mahanian. She is able to pull so much emotion out of her writers. And, you know, her notes, like, okay, this is great, but like, really go deep. What was she thinking in this moment? You know, how did he feel in this moment? She's so good. So she really helped round it out into what it is.
Oh, I love that.
But it is still so your voice, and it's obvious that your confidence comes through, that you know who you are, because this is a Tia Williams novel. And one of the things that makes your novels so amazing are the love stories. I mean, this is so true in this one. I love Miss Della. So your secondary characters are also always so alive. And she is talking to Ricky about love. And I want to talk about that a little. So this is Miss Della, 96 years old. She rents Ricky the apartment and kind of becomes a found grandmother to her. And she's talking about her marriage to her late husband. And she says to Ricky, "To me, love is like listening to an album. Some people skip to their favorite album over and over until it's familiar and cherished, and they know every note by heart. That's how Dr. Bennett and I loved each other. He was music I could listen to forever." And I just, I love that line. He is music I can listen to. I mean, Corinne and I both are music people that do literally listen to songs over and over and over. And lyrics really speak to me. And so that thought of love being like that was so beautiful. But in this one also, you have the faded soulmates aspect, which also we love. And that you write, "We're faded. It's why we keep running into each other. It wasn't coincidence. We were destined to fall for each other." So I want to hear your thoughts, sort of. What are your beliefs around faded soulmates and destiny when it comes to love?
I believe in it. I've experienced it. It is so hard to write because it's so hard to write because if they're already fated, if they are supposed to fall in love, the whole thing when you're writing a love story is that you have to build a case for them to be together. Like, you have to convince the reader that they're supposed to be together because of who they are. And so if a witch comes by with a magic wand and it's like, "You two forever," there's no case. It's just, it just is. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if you just rest on that, that's lazy writing, and it's also not satisfying for the reader. So yeah, it was hard to write.
Well, you make it look so effortless, by the way. But I have been thinking about this too, and I'm currently on my, you know how you like, you work with theories, especially as a writer, you're like, let me see what I'm working out right now. You know what I'm working out right now? Free will is the only thing that messes fate up. It's not fate or free will. It's like, will you get out of the way of your fate, or will you constantly mess up what is your fate? And I'm kind of that's on weird. That right now. Like,
interesting. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Well, your career, Tia, also seems somewhat faded. You are, I've heard you say, living the life that you've dreamed of for a very long time. We talked about it on our first episode and all the things that you've manifested, but not everyone in publishing and maybe in Hollywood too has always seen your vision. I've heard you talk about how the difficult journey to getting Jenna published and from her successful career as a beauty editor to that epic writer panel discussion in 7 days, which I still think about, and now this perfection of The Wilds. You've said, "I understood Black fabulosity because it was everywhere around me. My parents had an epic romance. My Aunt Diane was a fabulous big city career woman. We exist, but I knew those stories were not being told. Why are we missing from the page, from the screen? So I decided I would tell our stories." I just feel like that has always been in your writing and has just accumulated to the point that you can't look away from it anymore. Do you feel that way, or do you feel like you're still fighting for those pages and that time? Where do you feel you are now from maybe the rejections that you got with The Perfect Find?
No, I've reached a place in my career where people are listening to me with more trust because there's numbers behind it now. The thing, when you're a Black writer, you don't get the benefit of the doubt. You don't get to roll up on the scene and, you know, write a a quirky small novel about whatever the hell you want to write about.
And say, just trust me.
Right? Trust me. You can't. You absolutely cannot do that. And, you know, it's tough because there were so many promises made in, you know, 2020 about how publishing was going to change and diversify and, you know, start paying authors of color the same thing that, that the white authors were, you know, being paid, that we'd get the same kind of marketing push, we'd get the same distribution. And for a while that was happening. And I think now if you look around and you see a lot of the promises of that time have not really been kept for many writers. It is a lot, the landscape is a lot more diverse, but it's more than just signing a Black writer. It's, you know, are you going to promote it?
Champion,
are you going to champion it? Like, it, was it just to check a box? So, yeah, you know, it's still tough out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's, you've mentioned a little of the magicalness of this book. So I do want to talk about that. We usually talk about astrology, as you know, but we've had you on twice and already we've managed to mention it more than once in this episode already. But you give us plenty of sort of woo-woo to talk about anyway, because of course there's this sort of speculative magical element to this entire book. So we get a whole book of it and voodoo and witchcraft. And you do make even a joke about astrology being a cute little hobby. I know that was a joke, Tia. I know.
It was a joke.
I know it was a joke. But there are so many other, of course, references to magic, right? Even in the prologue, you know, you say this could be a wondrous and unknowable magic in the world. And there's another line about to believe in some magic is to believe in all. You couldn't be terrified of demons without believing in angels too. And just generally that the world is full of mysteries that we can't explain. So, you know, we are firmly in that camp here, with the universe and magical things and things we can't explain. But tell us about what it means for you and why this was something that you wanted to make such a huge part of the book.
A really superstitious person. Really superstitious. Like, I, any superstition, I buy into it. And, you know, my belief systems do not add up. I am not at all religious. I am into my zodiac sign, but I don't really know much about anyone
else. So Leo, by the way. So Leo.
Which is very Leo.
Yeah.
And I love, believe in them totally. Yeah. I'm not, you know, that line about if you're going to believe in demons, you have to believe in angels too. For someone, so I was raised Catholic. And for anyone who has ever been Catholic is always going to be scared of demons and hell, even if you don't believe in anything else. But that doesn't make any sense, because if you're scared of Satan, then you have to assume that everything else is true too. But it's all a mystery and there's no explanation. And I love unexplained things. I remember, there was an encyclopedia. This was very me at a summer party in 1987. This girl's dad had an encyclopedia, a Time Life encyclopedia of, what was it called? Mysteries of the Unknown. Mm-hmm. And after everyone went to sleep, insomnia, I would look through it and it would be, you know, it would talk about, it was different stories, you know, some kid who died from spontaneous combustion in the Victorian era, or, you know, mummies that got up and started walking one day, like all these things, stuff that has happened in space that no one can explain, stories of mysterious disappearances or people dropping in from the past. You know that story about the guy who showed up in Times Square and he was like dressed in old people clothes, and not old people, old timey, old timey clothes, and was like speaking this weird English. And this story's like that. And I was just obsessed with that. Like, no one knows what this is. You know, frogs falling from the sky. So I think I've always been interested in things that can't be explained. I'm drawn to that.
Same.
World.
Same, same. I love insomnia, but make it bookish. You're like, yeah. I can't sleep. Am I going to call my crush or no, I'm going to read about mysteries. Yeah. Like my hand is way up in the air. That is absolutely what I would have done.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Pre-internet, you know.
Yeah.
Surfing.
Well, another obsession that is clear from your book is Harlem Renaissance. And Harlem is essentially a character that comes alive in this novel. I know I've read, obviously, that you were super interested in that. And it sounds like it was one of the elements that came to you in the middle of the night. So it had to be part of this. But talk to us about that, because it really is just, it's when people talk about it being lyrical and transportive, like the book, that's this just all comes through that. So where does that obsession or interest come from? Have you always been interested in this?
I have. It's the glamour. It's so glamorous. I love the 20s. Mm-hmm. And again, insomnia. We would go to slumber parties at my cousin's house, but my cousins were the ages of my younger sisters. Like, there was no one my age, when we would go over to play and have sleepovers. And so when everyone was asleep, I would read my uncle's old Hollywood books. Like, he had all these, Hollywood Babylon and stuff like that, but then also, biographies of Rudolph Valentino and Greta Garbo and these like 20 stars, or like, a compilation of Hollywood fan magazines from the 20s. And so I would read them to see like the kind of lifestyle reporting that was happening in the 20s and what people were wearing and, dating questions. And, I just fell in love with the 20s. And through the 20s, I, landed on the Harlem Renaissance. And it was just this magical time where Black art was elevated to A+, valid, cool. Mm-hmm. And it spread all over the world. And I almost think of it as, it was so influential. And I almost think of it as like pre-hip-hop, because hip-hop totally changed the world, also came from New York, also Black people. And now you can't go anywhere where that, genre, that culture hasn't touched. And that's what it was like in the 20s. Hairstyles, fashion, the way people were writing. If you look at the Lost Generation in Paris, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, all those guys, they were so enamored by what was happening in Harlem, and they tried to emulate it. The musicians that traveled from Harlem at that time, brought jazz to Paris, brought, it was just a really eclectic, cool time, a very queer time, and there's just so much to be inspired by.
Yeah. And did I also read that Stephen King's Shining also had a little tiny piece of that too, like how the place has its own character.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing with the Overlook Hotel in The Shining is that the hotel was the problem. Jack Torrance. If the hotel had a heartbeat, the hotel, the memories were alive. And so I got this idea of this sort of haunted place, this haunted brownstone, a haunted piano, came from that idea.
Did the title come from your 20s inspiration? I know the Langston Hughes poem, Love Song for Lucinda, and I didn't know if that had anything to do with your title.
It did. I was very inspired by it. And then I was like, is it too long? Is this too wordy? And it wasn't until I saw it laid out when the design team sent over different options for the cover and I saw it laid out that I was like, okay, this is good. This is great.
Perfect.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So our first time that we talked to you about The Perfect Find, the novel. But since then, it has been adapted. We've watched it. We've discussed it. The Perfect Find on Netflix with Gabrielle Union. How was that? We, of course, followed along like couldn't take our eyes away from your social media about it. What was that experience like for you? Was it as amazing as it looked like? It was probably even better.
Speaking of glamorous, I mean.
Yes.
It was pretty amazing. I can't, I still am pinching myself, especially, I mean, you guys know the journey for the Perfect Fine was fraught. It was pretty, actually traumatic. It, you know, I was like, am I ever going to write again? I don't think so. So for the story to end in an actual movie starring Gabrielle Union and the fabulous Keith Powers, who I am convinced is the next movie star. It was the coolest thing ever. You know, I went to the premiere and it premiered at Tribeca Film Festival, which is just wild to me. Like in 25 years plus in New York, I've never been. And to be there for the first time, you know, to support a movie that was inspired by your baby, which came into the world in a really rough way.
Yeah.
It was right. It was a beautiful full circle moment.
I mean, and just to remind everyone, if they didn't listen to our first episode, Gabrielle Union was on your vision board for this movie.
Yes.
Talk about
yes.
full circle and magical thinking here, folks. Yes. I mean, you had her in mind. So not only did this come to fruition, you got your leading lady.
Yes.
And it was a vision board. This is important to say that I didn't even want to do and didn't even really believe in. And my friend was like, who had just become a life coach, he was like, you're struggling writing. It's going to help. You've got to do this vision board. No, not on Pinterest. You have to do it with your hands. You have to cut stuff up and paste things to the, like actually craft it. And I was like, fine. So I did that. And, you know, not only Gabrielle Union, the vision board was yellow and the cover of The Perfect Fine in all of its various, you know, its incarnations has been yellow. It's
oh,
wild.
Wow.
Oh,
I love
that.
And the guy was Michael B. Jordan, which made sense at the time because he was like 21. So, yeah. And I am firmly of the belief that the only reason Michael B. Jordan was not in this movie is because he was too old by the time he made it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we have loved watching that, and we loved watching that journey come to where it was supposed to come to, and we loved the movie, too. We couldn't get enough of it, so.
Thank you. Yeah, it was so, so exciting.
And we got a little, you even gave us a little Eva and Shane in this one, so we got to revisit 7 days in June. And so do you have anything you can tell us about maybe what's next or what, or maybe some development of that into TV?
Yes. Well, we're exploring right now.
Yes.
Okay. I can really say.
That's fine.
That's right.
We are, you know, exploring some options, but in terms of books on Monday, my latest manuscript is due. And it's a YA story featuring Audrey.
Yes.
Who is Eva's daughter in 7 Days in June. And so for the past year, I've been in her, you know, high school head, bringing her story to life. And so Eva and Shane are all in that. And you'll see where they are 4 years later and what their lives are like. Yeah.
Oh, and I'm sure your daughter is just loving that. Don't write anything that came from me, Mom.
Quite the opposite. She's like, use it all.
Yeah.
Use it all. Give
use
me credit.
Yeah,
I'm just going to say. I forget. I have teen boys. That would be the opposite. But you're right. The teen girl would like the full credit. Well, we cannot wait. We will obviously be, you know, super fans for life of whatever you create. So why don't you end, though, by telling us what you're loving? We love to hear what you're obsessed with, what you're reading or watching or listening to.
Okay. So I haven't read anything in a while because when I'm writing, it's hard for me to read. But the last thing I read that knocked me out was The Guest by Emma Klein, which, oh, my God. God, I love a grifter. I love a liar. I love a scammer. I love the Hamptons. So all of that was just a perfect con artist fiction. Yes, I love it. I am about to start True Detective.
Okay.
The Jodie Foster, latest season. Yep. Mm-hmm. So excited for that. I am obsessed with all of the Real Housewives, especially Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
and I really loved Barbara and Kennedy Ryan's newest book is not out, but it's coming out in March.
Yes, This Could Be Us.
Yes, This Could Be Us.
Mm-hmm. With a gorgeous cover.
Also. Yeah, the cover's so pretty. And
I loved her.
A really good beach read. One.
March 5th, that one is out. So next month after this. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Good. All right. Well, you've given us a lot to look into, to digest, and everyone should be reading A Love Song for Ricky Wilde. So good. So
absolutely
good.
The best.
Thank you guys so much. Always, you're so supportive, and I'm thrilled that you loved Ricky Wilde. It means a lot.